Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
I know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for me. I'm Justin Ling, your guest host for this week's episode. I'm joined by Elie Cantin-Nantel, the Ottawa correspondent for The Hub. Elie, hello.
Hello, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing just peachy. On this week's show, Domo Arigato, Mr. Roboto, Pierre Poilievre's got an army of automatons absolutely buzzing about a recent campaign appearance, and some intrepid cybersecurity experts think they found out who, or what, is behind pro-Palestinian campus protest. But I'm here to tell you, these are not the droids you're looking for. And then, an ambush interview with the Prime Minister on a beach in Tofino has me asking, are right-wing provocateurs the new vice? The answer is no, but I'm asking it anyway. Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk about the news. So, Elie, to kick off the show, I want to talk a little bit about something that the lamestream media has been totally ignoring. At the end of July, Pierre Poilievre held one of his famous Axe the Tax rallies in Kirkland Lake in Northern Ontario. While the media may have totally ignored the rally, I logged on to Twitter.com, my favorite website, and let me tell you, the vibes were impeccable. We heard from Cecile saying Pierre Poilievre's energy is infectious. I was at his rally in Kirkland Lake last night, and the crowd was electric. Someone else said that the energy in the room was palpable, that it's refreshing to see a federal leader taking time to listen to our concerns. Claretta said that the rally in Kirkland Lake was great and that I'm still buzzing from the energy. Wait, Vanessa also said, I'm still buzzing from the energy. Wait, we got people here from South Africa, Jodhpur, India, from Hawaii. They're all saying they're buzzing from the energy. Hang on, I'm starting to think that some of these accounts are bots. And, well, I guess the media thinks so, too. You can look at the headlines from Sue Today. Bot accounts flood social media with reviews of Poilievre's northern tour. CBC says online bot campaign backing Pierre Poilievre prompts call for probe by election commissioner. We got National Observer, the Tie, the Toronto Star, I think the Canadian Press. We got some others. And now we have these demands.
The NDP calling for an investigation into whether the Conservatives are using bot farms to build online buzz.
That is a sketchy behavior, and we need to know what it's about.
You can't have your electoral system being hijinked by dark actors. We need to know who those actors are.
A number of Liberal MPs wrote an open letter to Elon Musk calling on him to follow through on a promise to clamp down on bot activity.
Elie, help me out here. What is going on with this story? Is Pierre Poilievre using bots?
As of now, there may be evidence that will come out later, but I have trouble believing that the Pierre Poilievre campaign would buy bots. And the reason why is they don't need to. The support, if you look at the polls, they're something like 20% ahead of these other parties. They're doing incredibly well, and they have already this grassroots support, including at these rallies. There's just no need to buy bots, in my opinion. But the media's had to cover this because the NDP's talking about it. Now it's a political story. So there you go.
So let's break this down for people, because I feel like people hear a lot about bots these days, political bots. They probably heard it in the context of the 2016 U.S. presidential campaign. Elie, in your experience, have you ever come across an effective political bot in your life?
I would say not really, for kind of the reasons that you have stated. It just seems a little obscure, and I'll give you a couple examples of times I've encountered bots, though I, again, just didn't believe them. One day I log into Twitter, this was before the 2019 election, and the top trending thing is hashtag Trudeau has got to go to jail. Now, today, there may be a bit of belief that may be organic, given that there is now, you know, post-convoy, a group of Canadians that do want to see Trudeau go to jail. But back then, it wasn't really a thing. So this is an example. But again, I think very quickly, people kind of noticed these are bot campaigns. Now, that's not to say that kind of social media bots or misinformation has zero effect. It can definitely have some effect. But personally, when I look at me as a person, as a journalist, or even just as a citizen who votes in every election, I have not seen impactful bot campaigns. The only impact that bots have is to generating negative stories.
I think that's a really good point. I mean, and listen, this is really why I'm bringing it up. I think we've seen now a ton of this kind of fervor, and I feel like nobody has bothered to ask the question, do these bots work? Do they do anything? Do they have any impact? Has anyone ever changed their mind because of a political bot? It seems like if you really poke people enough to ask them to give you an explanation for why we should care that a couple hundred accounts are buzzing about Pierre Polyev's appearance in Kirkland Lake, the explanation is, oh, well, it might get Kirkland Lake trending. And it's like, when was the last time you gave a about what was trending on Twitter?
What I will say is I generally agree with you, though. As I said earlier, there's a political story here. And, you know, I used to work in politics before I got into journalism, so I know a bit of the inner workings there. And whatever you can use against your opponent, you will use it. And this one's a great story for them because, you know, of course, Pierre Polyev has this natural kind of organic momentum going for him, but he also has this narrative that the conservatives have had it ever since Trudeau got into office, that we're the party of ethics, we're the party of doing things right. So here you have a story where basically you can have a narrative that Pierre Polyev is paying for bot supporters and that they're doing so in an unethical manner. This is a great story if you're the opposition to Pierre Polyev. So I'm not surprised at all to see the NDP jumping on this wagon and the Liberals jumping on this wagon, and the media, of course, is going to cover it because that's what they do. But for this particular story, I would generally agree that I don't think it should be front page news.
So Ellie, this was not the only bot attack making news recently. Apparently, bots were involved in creating the McGill encampment protests, the pro-Palestinian ones that were just broken up by police quite recently. As Iran International tells us, a company called XPause or Expose, I don't know, it's spelled Expose, but what are you going to do? They use AI to ferret out disinformation online, and their report pops up on this website called Iran International, and it proclaims in the headline, Iran masterminded anti-Israel protest in Canadian university. And there's a quote from the cybersecurity firm claiming that Iran used a nefarious botnet to trick students using Farsi language tweets to get them to come out on the university campus and build a pro-Palestinian encampment. They say the primary takeaway is that there is a massive activity funded, coordinated, and organized by a foreign government that is influencing Canadians and Canada by driving incitement to violence and real-world activity. So let's go in the other direction. Ellie, is it possible that a botnet of Farsi language accounts run out of Tehran are in fact driving the pro-Palestinian sentiment on university campuses across the country?
I haven't seen the actual report.
Nobody's.
Right. I've only seen news articles about it. That being said, I think you could make a credible case because of two reasons.
Okay, come on, but okay, go on.
Here, let me just explain. Iran has openly supported these encampments. We also know McGill, until just last year, they had ties with Tehran University, which is known for radical anti-Israel and Islamist kind of views. And I can't tell you the report is right because, again, I haven't seen it, but I think there could be a case to be made. We've seen other foreign actors try to get involved in these different movements because it has become a great tactic for foreign actors to get involved in the domestic conflicts of a country to kind of stir up stuff. So my question would be, why wouldn't Iran get involved in these campus protests?
So Ellie, you and I have not seen the report. Like I said, the report has not been made public. They won't release it. They won't release any details. It seems like the only people who have seen this report are this website, which I should say has ties to the Saudi government. It's called Iran International, and the National Post, which I should say does not have ties to the Saudi government. But it's stark to me that the media has released very few details from this report. We're getting very little on the methodology, very little, it kind of except these sweeping generalizations. I'm such a critic of bad tech journalism, and this seems to be it. What would you expect to see from a good report, a good news story on this kind of earth-shattering report, which claims that Iran masterminded these protests?
Well, I would say that, look, it's sometimes you will get a report exclusively and you have to kind of talk about it. Just as many details as possible would probably be what I would like out of it. But what I will say is, again, I haven't read the report, so I can't 100% say I believe it because I like to see primary sources for myself. So I believe that just the pretext that Iran stands to benefit from these protests and would benefit from being involved is true.
But then you're kind of saying we have to believe what the Post's kind of summary of it, because other things are true. But that's not how this should, like, the Post should be able to justify the report on its own terms, right?
What I'm saying is that I am more skeptical, far more skeptical about the idea of Pierre Polyev buying bots and the allegations there than I am about this report, given the ties that the National Post has reported on between McGill and Iran. It's more believable. Is it because of bots or not? That remains to be seen. I would like to see the full report, but I think that the pretext...
It would have been nice if the Post gave us those details.
Sure, I'll give you that. But I think the pretext that Iran stands to benefit from being involved in this is absolutely correct.
Let me tell you a little bit about this company and about our efforts to try and get a hold of this mythical report that proves that Iran masterminded these protests. The company is called XPOS. It is a kind of Israeli slash Canadian slash American, I guess, cybersecurity anti-disinformation firm. We cannot find the corporate registration for this company. We know that they claim to have had ties with Mossad and Israeli intelligence, which is fine. A lot of, you know, revolving door between security and cybersecurity is normal. But I've communicated with the firm. They refuse to give us their methodology. They refuse to release the report. They refuse to give us interviews with any of the analysts who produced this report. And they refuse to tell us anything more than the claim that there is an Iran-run Farsi language botnet that is apparently the reason why this encampment exists. Now, let me just say, how is it that we can be so incredulous at the idea that a botnet is being paid for by the Conservative Party of Canada to support Pierre Polyev to get Kirkland Lake trending, but suddenly we have to treat it as super legitimate, or at least possible, or at least conceivable, that Iran is behind this encampment because some shady cybersecurity firm says so? Doesn't this kind of expose exactly why these bot stories are so infuriating? Because they become a cudgel and a tool to make your political point instead of, you know, a thing you have to look at analytically and thoughtfully and super skeptically.
Well, I would again say I think the scenarios are a bit different, because if you just look at the situations, there really isn't a reason why the Pierre Polyev campaign would need to buy bots. And we haven't seen, at least from my knowledge, Putin praise Polyev whatsoever. Meanwhile, if you look at Iran, again, why wouldn't Iran try to get involved in some way in these protests?
Oh, listen, if you want to criticize the encampment, by all means. What I think I'm going to keep poking at is this idea that as soon as you have this little kind of inkling of evidence of bots, it's a really useful sort of pot sweetener. You can kind of go, oh, well, I don't trust the students. I think they're bad. And also, by the way, bots. It's just such an easy and, I think, frankly, cheap way to delegitimize. And I think, listen, liberals and conservatives are doing it to Pierre Polyev right now. And now a bunch of conservatives, including a Montreal lawyer who tried to get an injunction against the encampment, who is running for the Conservative Party now, is trying to use it against these students at McGill. Listen, these students are, a lot of them, English-Canadian. Many of them come from Concordia as well. Many of them are local Montreal activists. They don't speak Farsi, by and large, right? Yet the allegation that they're being kind of led by the nose by Iran, including by this botnet that is, again, only supposedly tweeting in Farsi, I think is a little fantastical. And let me just leave you with one more thing. We actually have some really good research on exactly the impact of these botnets, because, of course, Russia tried exactly this in the 2016 presidential election. Some really smart researchers publishing in the journal Nature Communications in 2021 decided to look back. And many of the people who were actually, let's say, affected, I'm using that word generally, affected by the influence and the bot campaign, it followed up with them years later. And it found that there was no evidence of a meaningful relationship between exposure to the Russian foreign influence campaign and changes in attitudes, polarization, or voting behavior. Now, that doesn't mean we should not criticize Russia, just as we should, you know, absolutely still criticize Iran. But we should also be real alive to the fact that these things don't make a difference. And of course they don't, right? Seeing a clearly fake tweet from an obvious bot that has like 200 followers, if that, and like four likes, is not going to convince you to come out and join an encampment in the rain at McGill University in favor of a thing that, by the way, a ton of youth already deeply care about and don't need to be duped into believing. I think we're delegitimizing honest political conversation. I think it's incredibly corrosive. And I think if you want to engage with these people, if you disagree with the protests, if you disagree with their stance on Iran, if you disagree with somebody who supports Pierre Poilievre in Northern Ontario, fine. Engage them on those terms rather than saying, oh, well, it's only because you've been tricked by these nefarious robots. Like, that, to me, I find really bugs me. And I'll just plug my own work for a second, because I have a column in the Toronto Star running this weekend about exactly this question that I think is pretty good. Ellie, what did you bring in for your Duly Noted?
So I brought in a story from the National Post, and it talks about basically at the Museum of Nature, you had a few months ago a climate activist come and spray paint on one of the dinosaur fossils, and the story goes that it costed the museum $7,500 to clean up, and more importantly, it required a lot of work. And I was curious to get your thoughts on this, Justin. When I look at some of these kind of fringe far left protesters, like people like Extinction Rebellion or like Just Stop Oil, and some of the tactics that they use, such as going into a museum and causing vandalism that requires a lot of time to fix. So there was a case in the UK, and there were these protesters, I forget if they were vegan or climate activists, and they were just opening up all the milk and pouring it out on the ground. What happens is you have these people, and some of them do come from privileged backgrounds. There was these two YouTubers in the UK that infiltrated Just Stop Oil, and before their meetings, they would go to these fancy coffee shops and have like expensive lattes and whatnot. And then they go and they cause damage that causes more labor, more hard work for working class people, because it's not the CEO of an oil company that's going to come and clean up the mess. It's a working class person. And to me, it just kind of screams selfishness when they do these kinds of acts. And I just was curious to know if you agreed with that.
I mean, generally, yes. I mean, listen, like, I'm a big believer in civil disobedience, and I don't particularly care where you're coming at it from, as long as it's, you know, vaguely in service of good, let's say. And I think at the very kind of core, a lot of these Extinction Rebellion type protests, whether it's blocking traffic to protest over-reliance on oil and gas, whether it's haranguing politicians or pieing them or whatever, I think, you know, the actual sort of protest in service of a valid political message is fantastic. And I think even the kind of initial bits of protest in big museums to just garner attention made a ton of sense. And I think it was really effective for a minute. I look at a story of someone throwing red paint on a recreation of a dinosaur skeleton at the Canadian Museum of Nature as evidence that these people may have lost the plot to some degree. What is the message? What is the message of we made T-Rex slightly red? I'm reading this story, and I can't help but laugh at some of the language here, where they're kind of saying, oh, no, we're so sorry. We actually feel really bad about it. We're not actually trying to hurt the poor old T-Rex. What we want to do is highlight the vast inequities of climate inaction. But those two things no longer have any rational connection. And I can't help but feel like maybe it's time we innovate a new kind of protest. Duly noted. Okay, so Ellie, I want to talk about a really fantastic column from Robin Urbach in the Globe and Mail from earlier this month. It's about a story that I've been following closely and have been getting more and more frustrated with the fact that no one else, at least nationally, is actually covering. So it is basically the story of an appalling, in her words, homophobic attack in Canada, one that you didn't hear about. The short of it, as Urbach reports, is that in the early hours of June 23rd, two women in Halifax were walking through downtown. They are a couple. And by Emma McLean, one of the couple's telling, a man made sexually degrading comments towards her, which catalyzed into a verbal confrontation between Emma's girlfriend and the man. It turned violent. This group of men ends up assaulting them. They're on the ground. One of them suffers a broken nose, chipped tooth, several cuts and bruises, and they were viciously kicked and attacked. This story has all the hallmarks of a national story. These men were making homophobic, sexually degrading comments to these two women. They were viciously assaulted. It's caught on video. Police have confirmed the details of the attack, but let me ask you, have you seen this story in the national news, like, at all?
So I have seen the story because I don't rely solely on the legacy media for its work, Justin. Yeah, I have seen it. I mean, I'll just give you a bit of my thoughts. I thought it was appalling that it's not being covered. And I'll give you a little rundown. I mean, Robin Urbach mentions that maybe it's because they're Middle Eastern. And I would tend to agree with that. The legacy media, I believe, has an agenda. And when a story doesn't fit the narrative, they don't like to cover it. So when you don't cover these stories because you think, oh, the people are Middle Eastern, it gives off the idea that there's a double standard in the media and that certain people that may or may not come from countries or cultures that really don't like homosexuality can get away with it in Canada because we've decided that we're going to view everything intersectionally.
I will tell you what is happening. These particulars of this case is that we think that we actually don't really know the details of all of those who allegedly committed this assault, but we think that most of them probably were not white. We think some of them may have been recent immigrants, potentially from Syria or somewhere else in the Middle East. And we know that the two women involved made some, let's say plainly, some racist comments about the attackers in the hours and days after the fact. And I think it's fair to say that some of the editors and journalists who would have otherwise covered the story looked at it and said, there is too much potential here for this to be weaponized by the far right or racists or xenophobes. Let's not add fuel to the fire. Let's just lay off until more details emerge or the police, you know, conclude their investigation or whatever.
So in my view, that's why I think Robin was right, that they didn't cover it because they were Middle Eastern and because, as you said, they were worried about some kind of pushback. What I would say is I think the pushback from not covering this, and especially if it happens over time, is going to be far more damaging.
And that's exactly the point I wanted to get at here, is that we think we're helping and we're really not.
No.
And it really shirks our responsibility to cover the news, even if it's uncomfortable or unpleasant. And people are not stupid. They see that other cases of homophobic violence or alleged homophobic violence have gotten national coverage, and they see that this story hasn't. And I will say, just a quick shout out, there's some great local coverage of the story. CTV Atlantic, The Coast, did some really, really great stories that managed to cover this with a thoughtful lens without adding to paranoia or racism. And I think we should look to them as a great example of how we can do this. But I think deciding to just step back from the story is always the wrong call in these circumstances.
Duly noted.
That's Shortcuts for this week. Thanks for joining me. You can find me at Justin Ling at protonmail.com or on Blue Sky Mastodon. Just not Twitter, because I just can't. I read everything you send, though. Ellie, where can people find you?
So I'm on X, as it's called now. It's Ellie_MCN. You can find my work at thehub.ca, and you can also find me on my personal website, which is elliecantonmantel.ca.
Beautiful. This episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production manager is Max Collins, and our editor-in-chief is Karen Puglisi. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them at cfuv.ca.
if you had to build it all from the pieces of this broken wall, would you have the sense to do it all again? Sometimes I wonder how I made it here. So many times, many chances to disappear. There's no use fighting the weather. 'Cause in the storm, we gotta stick together. Some rocks were always gonna break.
Words and culture weaves conversations with indigenous language and knowledge keepers to learn, celebrate, and connect. Join us as we delve into distinct indigenous language families beginning in February.
Thank you.